Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Rando Schwartz and John O'Bacon, episode 72 for June 6th, 2009. Open Sim. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that's all about free, libre, and open source software. And with me, two of the kings of free, libre, and open source software. Of course, our regular host, Mr. Randall Schwartz.
Hello, Leo. Good to talk to you again.
Stonehenge. And he's becoming kind of a regular. Jono Bacon is also here. Hey, Jono.
Good to see you. How you doing?
Community manager at Ubuntu.
Ubuntu.
Oh, you added an N. Now I'm screwed.
Let's mix it up a little bit.
From Conical. And we are here to talk about... this is something you've been talking about for a while, having on, Randall, a clone of Second Life.
Essentially a clone of Second Life. We're going to be talking today with Justin Clark Casey, who is one of the senior developers on the Open Simulator project, also known as the Open Sim project. We've got him on. We'll have him on shortly anyway, and we'll be talking to him about this sort of – it's like a clone of Second Life. So you can basically take normal Second Life clients, like, you know, the things that Linden Lab ships, and connect up to these things instead, and it just all plays together somehow.
That's cool. I really love the idea. You know, both Jono and I are into Community, obviously.
And I'm not.
Yeah.
I don't know, Randall. Are you? Would you say you're kind of community-focused guy? I guess anybody who's in open source has to be kind of community.
Yeah, come on.
Community. Well, I don't know. I don't know. Jono's got a wiki and everything.
Oh, yeah. I've got a Twitter account.
When's got everything. Chuck Norris need a wiki? Come on. Chuck Norris doesn't need a wiki. He just impresses into you whatever he wants.
All right. Hey, when is the book coming out, Jono? I know that the kind of the community part of it is kind of winding down.
Yeah, it's so just doing the copy edit right now, and then it's going to be released mid-August. So it's going to be, it's going to be about 300 pages of possibly drivel, and then one page right at the beginning of pure and unparalleled wisdom from one Leo Laporte.
I will write that, and now you've really put me on the spot for that one. You can pre-order, by the way. It is on Amazon already. The Art of Community, Building the New Age of Participation. I'm very flattered that you asked me to write the foreword, Jono, and
I'm really pleased to do it.
I didn't come into this to learn about community. But as an old media guy who never really did have to worry about community, it's been an eye-opening and sometimes hair-raising experience. There's my lead. I just wrote. Let me write that down because it is both. It could be challenging. Sometimes it's challenging to have your audience talk back to you, but it's ultimately exhilarating and fantastic. And there is no better way to create, whether you're doing open source software or a TV show. It is wonderful. So I think it's
incredible. And part of the reason why I wanted to ask you is because I didn't want to have somebody that was too ethereal and theoretical about to write the forward. Didn't want it to be just an academic expose.
Right.
You know, I wanted somebody who was who's done it, who's been out there and done it.
I'm up to my knees in the community.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that's why I thought you were the perfect choice, really happy that you can contribute to it.
I love it. Oh, thank you. I'll have to think of something interesting to say.
Well, speaking of the TV show, since some of us are watching at home live, which we'll give instructions at the end about how to watch the show live.
I noticed
you may
shirt.
Notice.
Yes,
I don't know if you can see this, but our friend Lori LeBeau Walsh, who makes the T-shirts at artoftechtees.com or artandtechtees.com, whatever. Made me a shirt that is specifically Floss. It's the Floss Weekly shirt.
Well, you're the only guy plugging her stuff, so I'm so glad. What does it say? Floss?
It says Floss Weekly, and it's got free, libre, open source software in italic.
I am buying that. Because that
so cool.
Not merely promotes the show, but promotes the idea of open source software.
Oh, absolutely. Perfect. It says there, Floss Weekly at twit.tv down there. And it's really well done.
Now, I'm looking on their site. Where can I? I don't see it.
I don't think it's there yet. So you might have to just send her a special order and say, send me the Floss shirt. So but I'm sorry if it's not on the. It might be that it's just so new. Maybe she's just sent it to me to make sure it fit.
That's it. You're the beta. This is Floss beta. The Floss shirt in beta right
now. Maybe
she
forked one of the other shirts, and it's just the patch.
It's a fork.
We're not going to have this conversation.
Well, hey, I noticed, Jono, your shirt says Mr. Lazy. Now, that's a good shirt. I think I want that shirt.
It's a children's TV character from, like, in England. Great. I don't know if you got the Mr. Men and the Mr.
No,
Women.
We don't have that.
Yeah, it's 80s retro, baby.
Oh, I love it. So that means that's completely unavailable in any store.
And lazy is one of the three Pearl mottos, too, like lazy, hubris, and impatient. So.
And there's more than one way to twiddle a dial.
Exactly.
So I think we should say, anything else we want to talk about before we get going? You and I are going to go on a cruise to China soon.
That's coming up.
We will record ahead, I think, so that
I hope so. I'm trying to get lined up a couple of guests that we can do sort of in. You got like what, midnight to 2 a.m. free now? Is that is that the last slot available? Can I take midnight to 2?
You know, the week before, probably the 2 weeks before the cruise, I am going to be recording nonstop, and I have 4 lectures to write. So I am. It's going to be a little painful for the next month.
Can I be looking at your live schedule? Just keeps getting more. You got like 7 more shows now, don't you?
We added more shows, and we've decided to turn them all into podcasts. So, I don't. Somebody said my biography should be called Just One More Podcast.
Download this.
Just One More Podcast. Anyway, we'll talk more about that cruise and everything when we come back. But meanwhile, let's get our guest on the line. He is one of the lead programmers on the Open Simulator project. That's opensimulator.org. Justin Clark Casey. So it says here, from Southampton. Is that where we're... Are we talking to you in Southampton, Justin?
Yep, in the south coast of the UK.
That's great. The great seafaring port.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Well, welcome to Floss Weekly.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So you work for, during the day, you work for Black Dress Technology. Are you a seamstress?
I don't know. There's many ways you can interpret that, but no, I'm not. It's kind of like a very interesting twist to be working in that subtly. It's not what you usually expect when you have a programming job.
Oh, good. All right. You are a programmer using Open Simulator yourself, though, in your job.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
That's neat. You get to eat your own dog food, so to speak. Does Black Dress support the development of Open Simulator, or is it just a coincidence that you're doing that?
Black Dress, supports the development of Open Simulator. Yes. I started before I joined this company.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like a nice thing to get into because it's well, at first you always think it's nice when your hobby becomes your work. And after a while you find you have to separate them a bit more than you did previously.
So is Black Dress like a second life, but you could only wear black clothing in it?
Black Dress is a company that aims to effectively use OpenSim as a platform for product design and fashion design for the real world. Yes.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yes, it's very interesting because you're taking this this platform, which is kind of like being developed. I know we haven't gone into that much yet, but developed against kind of like the Second Life client effectively and developed in this context of virtual worlds and then looking to use it in another context entirely as a kind of standalone, part of a standalone application. So it's great being able to, you know, the all the different uses that people are able to put the project to.
So how different is it to Second Life? I mean, when I first heard about it, I was thinking, this looks really interesting. Second Life is interesting. A friend of mine who works at Second Life said there's more researchers interested in Second Life than anybody else. So, you know, and how does this compare? I mean, feature for feature kind of thing.
Well, feature for feature, it doesn't match Second Life at this point. Effectively, you've got a kind of situation. So in the beginning, of course, there was Second Life, and it was good. And the Linden Lab produced both a viewer and a server because it's a kind of a viewer-server architecture, or client-server, I should say, client-server. But we often call it a client-the-viewer. And then they took the step of open sourcing the viewer, which is, I think, quite unusual in the context of kind of virtual worlds and MMORPGs. And so a lot of interest, people got interested in hacking on that. But then somebody called Darren Gard came along, and he did the classic thing of basically looking at the kind of protocol the viewer is expecting and starting to implement the server side of that. And so he only implemented something really basic at first. So when you go into Second Life now, you see all the objects and all the activity happening. And at first, you know, I think it was just something like basically just a flat bit of land or just enough infrastructure to actually talk to the viewer and not have it crash on you and actually be able to kind of get through the login sequence. And then it's kind of grown from that, basically using the Second Life viewer as the template. Well, this is my point of view, the Second Life viewer as the template against which to implement, you know, bit more and more bits of functionality. And so we're growing from that. And now at the point where, you know, it implements a lot of it, you know, there's different estimates, maybe, you know, 90%. And so there's a lot you can do. So people can just take OpenSim and take it down to their own server and start it up. And then, you know, with a bit of fiddling, connect the ordinary Second Life client to it. So, kind of have their own Second Life system.
So did you start with the open client and reverse engineer the server based on what the client did? Is that how it worked?
Well, we've kind of got an interesting situation here in that the Second Life client is GPL. But the people who started the server really wanted to do a BSD server because, you know, their view was that there's a greater flexibility there. And so we kind of have this situation where we're not allowed to look at the client. This is the rule self-imposed by the project.
Oh, interesting.
Just in case, you know, there's any question of, I mean, you know, obviously this is kind of a topic which gets debated a lot, but whether there's any kind of risk of the GPL kind of knowledge leaking into OpenSim and then having a situation where, you know, suddenly OpenSim has to be GPL for some reason.
Chinese war.
Yeah, exactly. So essentially, people just inspect what's coming in and out of the client, and they do... I don't know if I call it reverse engineering myself, because to me it's more like listening into a conversation and then supplying the other end of it rather than, you know, disassembling a black box view or anything like that. But, you know, reverse engineering, a lot of people call it. And so, yeah, that's essentially what happened. It was kind of like looking at the view and then implementing the server side of that.
Have you ever been able to see the server code, or is that...
Oh, no. I think that's another big no-no.
Right.
When you say the server code, the actual Linden Lab.
Yeah, yeah. That would be... Then you have to do this in a clean room environment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's all clean room. It's all clean room implemented.
So this is the protocol that Linden Labs invented to go between their server and their client, but you're just watching it on the wire and figuring out from that to figure out what your server building from scratch has to do.
What it has to say.
Exactly. Wow. A lot of this work was done by other people. Basically, it's the usual standing on the shoulders of giants situations where a group of people, John Helibert and John Radford and other people, went and effectively did that work to analyze the protocol first because they were interested in kind of writing what they call, you know, writing bots. Sorry, just a second.
Oh, I see. Second Life bots that would interact with the Second Life server. Yeah.
Exactly. And other kinds of applications which could...
How easy is it to look at the traffic and say, oh, I see what's going on?
Well,
I can take a guess.
It's not in plain English, I'm guessing.
It's not in plain English. Okay. No.
It's in American English.
It's not quite fine. So once somebody, you know, there are kind of tools which have existed to look at it and kind of format the whole thing. But I mean, Wireshark is, I guess, you know, one thing that people use. But then in this LibSecond Life project itself, there's kind of like a program called SL Proxy, which does a better job of formatting because it understands the protocol much better and allows you to see what's happening.
Wow. So it sounds, so one thing I don't quite understand here is I was under the impression that Linden Lab, they've open sourced the client, and they are planning on, at some point, I was under the impression, open sourcing the server as well. So isn't this a lot of running around for ultimately no real reason? I don't want to, you know.
No, sure.
I don't want to give you a downer on your project, but surely we're going to get there again.
I kind of regret it now. You've pointed out that it's taking such a waste of time.
It's all right. We're still friends.
Never mind. All right. That's good talking to you. Take care.
See you later.
See you later, pal.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Cause I think back when the project was started, that was the situation. And so, yeah, I think Darren started originally just kind of like as an intellectual exercise. It was just kind of an interesting thing to see if you could do it. And then over time, you know, the project has grown. And now Linden Lab, I think, have actually rowed back from releasing the server as open source. I mean, you know, you kind of hear things, but, you know, I've talked to a Linden Lab representative and they said, well, you know, you've kind of done our job for us in a way. I mean, you know, there's no real reason for us to release the server.
Oh, nice job, Justin.
You know, yeah, you're kind of out there.
So what is their attitude towards OpenSim? I mean, do they...
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, Linden Lab's a very interesting company because I'm sure you've talked to them before, you know, of all their different kind of organizations, the Love Machine and they're kind of like the way they motivate people. But also they, and this is my view, you know, I have to be careful here that, you know, I'm representing a bit myself and other people agree with me, but then, you know, I don't want to speak for everybody. But I think they're a very open company and obviously they open source the viewer. And their attitude towards us has actually been very, very friendly. In fact, there have been experiments actually teleporting between OpenSim and between Linden Lab's servers. Mm. And Linden Lab are very interested in producing kind of open protocols to enable that kind of thing to happen. So they're
that's
actually, cool. Yeah, they're,
well,
they're very
that's,
much...
that's forward thinking, and I think they're right. I think ultimately the idea of many servers supporting this protocol and federation between servers solves a big problem for them. Because they don't have capacity for everybody who might want to use it.
It'll be interesting to see once you get the specification from them how many things you got right and how much more of that there was to figure out.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting now because I mean, it's hard to tell sometimes because you can live in this bubble where a lot of people talk about OpenSim and you think, wow, this is really big. And then really, you know, how big is it really? But it's interesting that OpenSim itself has started to innovate in this area independently of Linden Lab. So there's somebody called Krista Lopez, who's actually an academic in the University of California, Irvine, who has done a lot of work on something called the hypergrid, which is this idea of connecting. When we say a grid, of course, we're talking, you know, a grid like Linden Lab's kind of grid, but usually in OpenSim's case, much smaller. But this is kind of a protocol which allows you to teleport your avatar between different grids hosted by completely different people. And so there's kind of like this very grassroots, ground-up kind of innovation which is happening and kind of experimentation, which is a lot of what happens in OpenSim, just people kind of playing around the code and seeing what they can do. So you know, there's almost kind of like a different strand there, which is, you know, become entirely, grown up entirely separate from the Linden Lab-sponsored efforts. So there's kind of like competing visions and there's very interesting situations that, you know, how do you resolve those and what's the future going to look like? Who's going to win? Is it, you know, the kind of dirty implemented stuff that's already been implemented or, you know, is it the more architected stuff which, you know, might get specified out and then kind of built up more?
It seems really exciting because I can imagine that, I mean, I've played with Second Life a little bit. I've not played with it extensively, but I can imagine that, you know, when it started off as a project, the opportunity to innovate at Linden Lab was greater because, you know, they were a small company and all the rest of it. Now they're quite a big company and they've got millions of people who are using their service. So I can imagine yes. that like any software project, the innovation happens slower because they've got to deal with things like stability and security much more than they probably used to because there's so many more users. Do you think that that's where you folks have got an opportunity is to really, really innovate in new and different areas? Is that kind of what you want? Can you see yourselves kind of moving away from the Linden Linden kind of approach?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, in fact, and, you know, this was a very big vision. When I mean, Darren, you know, our founder's kind of vision of the project was that let's not limit ourselves to Second Life. Let's try and build a really modular platform so that eventually other kind of viewers can come along and use that basic server infrastructure. And so you're not just, I mean, I wouldn't say it derisively because of course Second Life, you know, is a really successful thing, but you know, you're not just there you're not just there to clone Second Life. You're kind of there to try and build something which is more adaptable. And so we have this, you know, we try and be adaptable. We try and have these modular systems where you can just plug in different modules to enable different things. There's a lot of different modules. There's one to kind of integrate with IRC, and there's modules to kind of like move the contents of entire sims about. So you can send a sim to another person and they can load it on their open sim. And you know, there's all kinds of different modules. And this is a game where a lot of innovation happens because the interfaces aren't great yet. I mean, they're all kind of, this stuff has grown so organically that it's very, there's a lot of, not, it's one of these classic open source things. There's not a huge amount of documentation. and a lot of things change really rapidly. But once you, if you really spend a lot of time and get to understand it, you can just plug into events and got kind of other stuff coming out of the sim and kind of like implement all kinds of different things.
I would think that one thing you'd want to look at, and I'm sure you're looking at this already, is that you know, the physics model of Second Life is fairly limited, and there are some very powerful open source physics models out there now for all this, these new high-end games that are being created. And it would be interesting to plug in a more complex, more powerful physics model inside your simulator, because then using the normal viewers, you could still emulate a much more complex physics.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so there's a core developer by the name of, who goes by the name of Tervis Overs, who basically took an open source project called the Open Dynamics Engine, I think it's called, and kind of basically adapted that to work in OpenSim. So actually, that's the most complete physics implementation in OpenSim. So that's kind of the standard engine that people use. But I know that other things have been done privately. There's a project, for instance, to basically do kind of like turn OpenSim into an astronomical tool, and actually use there's actually a sophisticated physics simulation in that. And so, you know, people are adapting it to this kind of end. And, you know, there's other plugins about this. There's Bulletex as well as another possibility, although that's kind of like less complete than ODE. And there was talk of even doing Havoc at some stage. So, yeah, it's a very interesting area.
It'd also be fascinating to take the open data available for the Earth, you know, the publicly available images and things like that, and build a real Earth in OpenSim with real size and physics, and then we could all be meeting in virtual Earth on real Earth.
It's interesting you say that, because another strand of this is that people have been experimenting with actually mapping real geographical data to OpenSim terrain, not really in the physics sense, but in the sense that you can, you know, fly over a city or fly over an area.
Cool.
Yeah. Do you think are we going to start seeing more and more projects that depend on geographical regions working together? So what I'm thinking here is, for example, Open Simulator could be interested when mixed with something like Flight Gear, which is an open source flight simulator. Do you think it's going to make? Because I think what would be really interesting is if I logged into a virtual world, and then I could see somebody flying over me who's actually playing a game. And it seems like what will be interesting is to have like a standardized world in which all of these different games and things like that take part in. Is that kind of...
That's definitely... That's a very interesting view. I think the real barrier here is that everything is so early, if you like. The OpenSim project itself has only been around for just over 2 years. And architecturally, I think there's a long way to go, because, of course, we've kind of come from the kind of classic Second Life architecture is quite centralized. It kind of like depends on centralized services, and it kind of operates in a very distinct way. You know, you get these fixed size regions of 256 by 256. And you get, you know, you've got this very kind of fixed model, which probably isn't, I don't know how suitable that is for something like Flight Gear, but you can imagine in the future, you know, as standards evolve. And this is where it's so early that there are no real open standards. This whole thing of reverse engineering the protocol is great, but then of course you get situations where the protocol suddenly changes with no warning, and people kind of scrabble and make things work again. But it's not great if you're trying to integrate lots of different things. So we're kind of pre-standards here.
I guess the other problem is the fact that, you know, whenever you talk about something like this, you get crackheads such as ourselves coming up with all of these ideas.
it's great. I mean, there's a huge amount, there's a real massive amount of imagination and innovation going on. I mean, every day there's something new at the moment, and it's really amazing. It's really amazing.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
So is this being used then? You know, you're saying you're using it in your business. Is it being used in other businesses yet? Are there commercial applications already starting to show up around OpenSim?
So I think there's two sides to this. One of them is that people are actually operating kind of alternative grids to the Linden Lab grid using OpenSim software today. So for instance, one of the most interesting projects is one called OS Grid. which essentially has historically had very close ties to the OpenSim project, because they tend to update. This is going to sound crazy. Well, this might sound crazy to you, but people always update to the bleeding edge code. I mean, you make a little change in OpenSim. We use a subversion. You make a revision to say R9047, and then the next 5 minutes, massive numbers of people have updated to that, giving you saying, "Hey, you've just broken X, Y, and Z." And OS Grid is actually full of these people who basically are upgrading their kind of region servers, we call them, all the time, and so they're constantly testing the new software. And this is kind of a grid, quite unlike the Linden Lab grid or other grids, where they control all the region servers and all the software there. But in OS Grid, there's kind of like a set of central services, your asset and your inventory and those that kind of stuff. And then anybody can come up and hook up their own region server to your grid. Mm. So there's this kind of massive distributed thing, and people just kind of like, getting some dedicated server on the net and just coming along and saying, I'd like to hook up in this grid space here. And there you go, they're hooked up. So it's, it's a fascinating project because that's a very different model. So that's kind of one application which is kind of there today, and people are doing it for that. But I think also very interesting is the idea of using it in standalone applications. So I've already mentioned the one being done by Black Dress, but companies such as IBM, for instance, are experimenting with this. They've kind of like, a researcher in IBM produced a virtual data center using OpenSim. And they've also they also hooked up their Lotus SameTime, which is their instant messaging client, to kind of like very quickly bring up an OpenSim server and kind of hold a virtual 3D meeting. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of released applications, but there's a lot of experimentation going on, and by some quite big companies.
And the way slight boring technical question, but so the way that it works in Second Life right now is the processing is done on the server, and then it essentially feeds the hard processing seems to be done on the server, then it feeds it to the client. And one of the limitations of that is, from what I can tell, is that it means that the client's always going to be kind of graphically limited in terms of how it can use the underlying 3D accelerated technology sort of thing. So, yes. If you look at Second Life, it looks much more primitive than, for example, PlayStation Home. Yes. Is the plan to keep doing that? Or, as more and more people are buying laptops and desktops with ultra fast gaming hardware, is there a possibility to actually make use of that?
I think one of the basic reasons for that, now I must put a disclaimer in here, that I'm really not a graphics expert by any means. I kind of like tend to do a lot of server side stuff. Oh. But I think one of the major reasons for that is the fact that there's so much user generated content is such a central, and streamed content is such a central thing. And I believe as far as I know, the kind of the fact that you're streaming all this stuff down from the server and you don't know it in advance means that you can't do a lot of the neat tricks a game would do in order to actually decide what you don't need to render or kind of like, all the kinds of optimizations you can do. So this is all, a lot of this is triggered, I think, by user-generated content. But at the same time, user-generated stuff or stream-down stuff is such, it's so important for virtual worlds that I don't think you'd move away from that. I think you'd just have to wait until, you wait until the hardware catches up, I guess. It's a case of things getting better there.
I know that recently... Second Life has been moving to a model where the physics of intersections and the physics of what something looks like from different angles and interacting with different lighting conditions is actually done client-side. And this is one of the reasons, for example, why in a particular area you can only have n number of objects before it starts really slowing down, and it slows down everybody's computer, everybody's client computer, not just the central servers. I know because as an experiment once, I bought a space in Second Life and I filled it full of bouncy balls. It was going to run through them, and everything got really slow. And I was told that slows it down for everyone, even whether they're looking in my direction or not, because it has to compute the physics for that on client side of everybody that's in that square.
Yes. I mean, there's that scalability problem. It's kind of interesting. The architecture, that classic view of server architecture kind of limits you in that way, because you end up having these fixed spaces on servers which have to handle more and more computation. So that's why you can't have many kind of individual avatars in a particular region. You kind of trying to overload the same bunch of computing resources. And I think the same is true for those kind of physics calculations. But there's kind of research going on to see if you could get around that. And this is where you get into very interesting questions of fundamental architecture and whether how much you can adapt the underlying fundamental architecture to serve different things. Because there's different open source projects out there. I mean, there's the Croquet. I don't know if you've heard of the Croquet. I guess they're big. Yeah. So yes, so they have a very different...
What is it? Tell me about it. I'm curious.
They have a very different peer-to-peer architecture. So instead of having a single server and hooking all your clients up to that, you kind of like just have people creating this shared space as they hook up their programs to each other. And so those shared spaces aren't permanent. They're just kind of there as long as all the peers are there. And whether you can, you know, that's a very different architecture. And whether the fundamentals of that architecture really reach down into the guts of the thing and you know, how far can you adapt even an open source open sim to do that? And you're kind of meeting fundamental architectural constraints. So it's quite interesting, you know, the idea of whether you can adapt things to serve more avatars or whether you've got, you know, a fundamental block. I mean, there are definitely people doing research on this and actually using OpenSim as part of, as the base of that research. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that goes in the future.
How are you at having a lot of avatars in one area? Could you have like a rock concert and have it make sense?
No, not at the moment. No, I think you start to get more than around 30 avatars and everything kind. You know when you've crashed because suddenly everybody starts floating off into the distance. None of the calculations are being, none of the checks are being done anymore.
Oh, that explains a lot, actually.
That was something I was talking to the Second Life people about this a while back because I was interested in organizing like a big Ubuntu event in Second Life.
You can't do these great big events in there, which is frustrating.
But it's really limited. I think the limitation in Second Life is about 200.
Even if you buy an island, you're stuck. And that I was very interested when it first came on the scene and doing shows there and so forth. 200 people, there's no point. There, we have 700, 800 people in our chat room constantly. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
There is that counter argument that once you get to that number of people, then you're not going to have any I think I've heard this before. You don't have interesting interactions anymore. You're kind of like, you come back to the kind of crowd and speaker kind of mentality. But you're right. I mean, because we have that same fundamental architecture as Lindelab Second Life, we're kind of limited by the same things at the moment.
Right.
I don't know about the whole limited the interaction thing, because I can imagine walking on stage in front of 250,000 virtual people. That's one pretty cool interaction.
That's the rock star, Jono.
Yes!
No, but I hear this a lot. We were talking about Wave on Saturday when Google Wave came out, and people said, oh, no, that many-to-many, that's not possible. And I'm not convinced. I think that might be... I mean, I know it's technically difficult to do. But I'm not convinced that community-wise it's impossible.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's a discussion for another day.
Another day.
And one of the things you could do is, and just thinking out loud, is to get it to scale like that is, obviously, if I'm in a group of 100 people, I can probably only see the shoulder movements of the people that are facing ahead towards. And I certainly don't need to know where the arm positions are of the people behind me, unless they're a little too close, I guess. but I mean, there's a lot of data that if you knew what not to transmit, you could avoid transmitting it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe with more sophisticated things. I think at the moment, for instance, OpenSim does something very kind of fairly primitive. You get that exponential scaling problem where every time you add a single person, everybody else gets to know their movements, and so every extra person, you've got a kind of a I'm not classically a computer science, but the kind of like the O power, the kind of O notation. But anyway, you get kind of like this exponential growth in things. But maybe it's... but I know, for instance, I think Lindelab is a bit clever in that respect, in that they don't send all the information all the time. So this is, I think, why we can't simulate quite so many people ourselves. But one of the great things about open source is that people suddenly come along and they suddenly solve these problems. Kind of like, you know, patches pop out of nowhere of people who have been looking at this and suddenly, you know, you've kind of... the whole thing is sped up because somebody's gone and giving you a patch to fix that.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because this problem's been solved in the graphics arena because they figured out what hides other things on a graphics chip so they don't have to have the computations for all the panels at once. Interesting. Maybe there's something you can scale from using, you know, a graphics language or graphics processing that would work the same way for the sim.
I think it's a very interesting problem. I think there's a lot of room for kind of innovative thinking and research in that area.
Mm-hmm.
There's where open is so great.
Exactly.
So, you can do it.
In terms of the Second Life client, I mean, something I saw very recently. I dip into Second Life every so often. Was they've got spatial audio. So, I had a meeting with someone who I know at Linden, and of course, they have their meetings in Second Life. It's kind of weird having a meeting with a unicorn, you know?
let alone a unicorn coming up behind you.
Yeah, exactly. Don't play hopscotch with a unicorn. We were kind of like sat in this meeting, and what was cool was the fact that the people to the left of me, it was spatial. I could hear them at the sort of left side of my headphones. Is that are you reverse engineering all of that kind of content that's coming through the client as well?
We're not quite there yet. The interesting thing is that I'm not a big expert in this area, but some of those components are actually provided by other companies. I think the SL Voice, for instance, which is the executor that handles that, is supplied by Vivox. I'm not sure how much Linda Lab has to do with that, and I think it starts to get more complicated. One thing we do have a basic voice. We kind of use another project called FreeSwitch, was recently integrated, so you can kind of have a region of a voice, but nobody's yet kind of gone and looked at the data and seen if you can do kind of spatial stuff. So I don't think anybody's got there yet, but somebody might.
Yeah.
I know the OpenAL stuff is supposed to do good 3D rendering for sounds. If you can get it down into recognition of, latitude, longitude, and maybe altitude and volume, and be able to render it back in there. I think Second Life's doing some of that already.
Right.
So are you right now, we've got, if you use Second Life as well, you log into a single grid and off you go, and you can go and fly around and buy feet and whatever else people do in Second Life. I don't really know.
Not just feet either, let me tell you.
Meters.
All sorts of things.
Oh, I have a Second Life experience. Anyway, so
people sell some very interesting things in Second Life.
That's a nice way to put it.
Okay. Is there a main open sim grid that people use? Or I understand there can be lots of them, but is there kind of a main place where people go and hang out and whatever else?
I kind of don't want to favor anything too much over anything else. I don't think it's clear. I mean, there are kind of large grids run on different bases. Some are run kind of commercially, and they've actually kind of looked at implementing the money system. Yeah. And then there's places like OS Grid, which are kind of run on volunteers. So I know quite a few people who hang out on open OS Grid, but I don't think there's no major single grid out there yet. I mean, it's all really, we're kind of like at these very early stages. It's kind of like, I don't think anything's even, a thousandth the size of Second Life yet. I mean, probably people will correct me actually on that. But I think, everything's still quite small at the moment.
Cool.
It's kind of like Twitter and Identica, how this kind of open source thing appears, and it's very small, but you have a very distinctive kind of set of individuals on that.
Oh yeah, the community is really, really great. Yeah, it's a very passionate community.
Can we get a bit geeky for a second? What's this implemented in, and what kind of database does it use?
So this is implemented in C#.
That's why he was reading a C# book. You don't think he does it for fun, do you?
Yeah, no, it wasn't casual relaxation.
Whose choice was that?
That was...
No, I don't think... Is C# that bad a language? Is it really that awful? Is it?
Yes.
Oh. I don't know. The trouble is I come from a Java background, so C# to me is actually not too bad. It's kind of quite nice. I think basically a lot of people came from the Windows side of the fence, and so that was the natural language they picked. Of course, we have Mono, which a lot of people use in Linux to actually run the simulation, and that's coming along nicely. In fact, it's quite interesting. We often hit bugs in Mono because we're kind of like pushing things in various directions, which people don't, aren't done by other applications. We do so much multi-threaded stuff, as you can imagine, in the server. Mm-hmm. And kinds of interesting things like it used to be the case that if you locked a timer object, your kind of virtual machine would mysteriously crash every so often. And kind of like things like that. So it's all done. It's the language of C#. But I can only apologize for that.
Well, can you imagine if it was written in Perl?
Hey, at least it'd be understandable.
Not just Perl, one line of Perl. It'd be great.
Yeah, just one line of Perl.
One long, long line.
With lots of punctuation.
Yeah.
and so what do you use to hold the data? Is it, you got databases in there?
Oh, right, yes. So we kind of support three databases. We support SQLite. Which I know you did a program on quite a long time ago. That's a very interesting program.
Big fan of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And it's very good for getting up and going very quickly. Of course, I think the author himself would know, it's not written for really massive amounts of
right.
data manipulation. So you kind of get to a stage where suddenly everything's really, really slow, and you're kind of outgrowing it. But then we also support MySQL, and also MS SQL. Is kind of like supported by the community. And then there's kind of like experimental nHibernate plugins. And of course, they allow you to do Postgres and Oracle's databases and all kinds of things. So we actually have a very broad kind of database support.
Now, you say you're a Java and C# programmer. Is the code well structured, or does it look like 17 people have hacked on it and all made it a mess?
I think it's very interesting. It's grown really organically. And you can imagine it kind of gets quite twisted. So one of the things...
That's a nice euphemism.
I mean...
And what a dog leaves behind is organic too, Leo.
Yes, that's true.
It's very organic in that sense. So some of it is a battle against entropy. So there's some really... Well, I will say, because I've seen it, there's some really nasty things lurking down beneath in the undergrowth. And it's quite interesting. So one of the things I'm personally been trying to do for quite a long time, if I try not to get too geeky here, but basically the second line, the Linda Lab architect, the protocol kind of essentially, if you want to see the creator of an object, everybody's represented by a UUID, a unique ID. And so that's fine when you've got one grid. Everybody has the same unique ID. But if you want to move... I'm very interested in actually moving content between grids, and this is breaking the model, if you like. So suddenly you've got a situation where you can't rely on everybody having the same UUID everywhere, because that's just not possible in a distributed environment. So I'm looking at, you know, actually having string kind of creator IDs. But then you start hitting, well, the whole thing's being architected around UUIDs, and everything expects a UUID, and you're kind of trying to reverse engineer in a kind of like a string thing instead, and you start hitting all these compromises and barriers. So it's quite tangled down there. So it's kind of going to be very interesting to see exactly how this evolves and how far you can get, and whether you reach a point where you think, oh, wow, you know, you've got to rewrite this now, or you've got to try something really different.
Couldn't you solve that with UUIDs with aliases? Because they could be uniquely generated on their grid, but when they go to across another grid, they just need to alias it over to whatever local identity it might be too.
Yeah, this is more kind of like, one of the scenarios here is actually you produce an item on your own system, and then you make that available on your website for anybody to download. So they might put it into systems where they have no knowledge of who you are. So I guess you'd never go there and alias yourself. Kind of the whole thing's got to be carried inside the object in some way. And that is kind of the essential approach. You kind of start doing mucky stuff like carrying those profiles across, and maybe you do you have a URL somewhere which you point to, and you get the data that way. And yeah, it's kind of like really tricky. It's really tricky. It's really interesting to try and work on that stuff.
And how do you do distributed development?
We use Subversion. We have the classic kind of IRC channels, and everybody kind of hangs out in that. Mm-hmm. We do stuff like continuous integration and unit, and we have a certain number of unit tests, and so everything's coordinated that way. And one of the interesting things, again, is that up until fairly recently, a lot of the work has been filling in the blanks generated by the viewer. This is my view. So we know the viewer expects, say, a certain inventory response if you kind of get an item. And so we know exactly what to do. And so you don't need to design anything. You just kind of let people go and submit patches, just kind of fill in the blanks without needing any coordination. But now that we've kind of like implemented a certain amount of that functionality, it's like, well, where do you go next? What's the next thing? And that starts to take actual design and process. And so I think we're at this very interesting point where the question is, how do you get processes? How do you evoke processes to actually allow you to do design in a fairly distributed way and yet not get bound up in too much bureaucracy and process? So we're at a very interesting point, I think.
We should take a look at how the Linux kernel is done, because there's a lot of that has to go on for that. And that's what they invented Git for, was to be able to do some of that. I know SVN is probably going to be your bottleneck at some point in there.
Yeah. Linux is an interesting point to me, because my understanding is that Linux effectively kind of like looked at what a patch is going into the kernel. So there was kind of a development structure whereby he was kind of like the visionary, the kind of like person who had the whole view, who had the whole thing in mind and could actually control it. Whereas in OpenSim, we have a very, almost an anarchic process. People kind of do what they want. I don't mean that in any bad way, but we don't kind of plan beforehand. People kind of like get a good idea and they go and implement it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it, most of the time it's good, but occasionally it's kind of bad. And so we effectively try and fix things in post rather than plan ahead in advance. And it's a, it's an interesting question to me as to how far you can take that. It's kind of worked pretty well up till now. But I don't know how well it works when you try and do proper design. But these are just my views. I mean, mm-hmm. It's kind of speculation, really. But it's kind of interesting because we're young and we're at this point where, you know, suddenly you have these kind of questions start popping up.
Well, what are you looking for in terms of more resources? What would help you? What kinds of people would be interested in OpenSim and helping you move it forward?
I think one big thing is more developers, basically.
Okay.
We have surprisingly few people actually developing. There's quite a few people who contribute patches, but people who actually do a lot of work in the core, the real core of it, are actually pretty few. And there's a lot of, we already have a lot of people submitting bug reports. We have this, you know, runaway, I think we have this runaway mantis where more and more bugs come in and nobody can look at them anymore because it's just like bug after bug after bug. So really it's development people, just kind of like, that's our biggest bottleneck, I feel.
So you said earlier on that, I thought it was really interesting earlier on when you said that you weren't really a graphics guy. And my assumption, if I was a C# developer and I was interested in contributing to the project, is that I'd need to know what splines are and all of this graphics mumbo jumbo. You say that you're not a graphics guy. So what kind of developers are you looking for? What kind of skills if someone's listening to Floss Weekly right now and they're thinking, I'm interested, I program in C#, but I'm not a graphics person, what can they do?
Right. So my background is, I worked at IBM for a number of years on enterprise software. And so my background is very much that kind of very careful kind of programming and trying to think these things out and kind of not graphical at all. And so, you know, any kinds of people, the one thing about OpenSim is it's such a big project. You've got all these different components. You've kind of got the kind of like the essential server kind of stuff. You've got physics, which is another thing in itself. You've got a kind of scripting engine in there, which is, again, something you can separate from all the stuff and people who are interested in that kind of thing. And of course, there's the kind of like the client view protocol. And then there's the graphical stuff, because although we don't do the graphics ourselves, you know, if you really want to understand certain things, you've got to have that knowledge. So there's room for a lot of different people, both people who really know about the graphical front end, which would be great because we really need those people, but also people who are more interested in physics and in just basic, you know, basic enterprise programming skills, I feel. Mm.
Fantastic. It sounds great. And have you actually found a unicorn in one of these worlds yet?
You love these unicorns, don't you, Jonah?
Well, you know, don't knock it till you try it.
I'm sure if you went
They like virgins, Jono. That's one good thing. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Justin. I stepped on your...
I'm sure I would be incredibly surprised if it wasn't a unicorn knocking about somewhere.
That's the greatest answer.
In a black dress.
In a black dress.
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of that, what does happen on April 1st?
Well, traditionally, the OpenSim core developers have liked to play a little joke on April the 1st. Because as you can imagine, doing this kind of thing, there's an immense amount of great practical jokes you can do. So this year, the kind of joke was to basically, there was a very, very neat hack, which basically transformed everybody's avatar into kind of a stick figure. So instead of being their normal self, they kind of like became this really elongated person. And it was only for April the 1st. It was kind of a time release thing. So it was kind of sitting in the code a couple of weeks beforehand. And this was always in the kind of development versions, never in kind of the release versions. Mm. But I think this kind of caught people unawares, and there was actually a significant, quite a few people who are kind of like, seem to be very upset by this. Like, it's like, what have you people done to my avatar, my beautiful avatar? Why is everything so odd? And it actually got really, it was really illustrative because people are really, it just shows how passionate people are about this. You know, people were kind of saying, oh, well, I think this was, we were getting into the trolling phase by then, but people were saying, oh, you guys should go to jail. You're kind of like criminals. It really got very, 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 very heated. It was kind of like a minority, but still. And it was very interesting. It was kind of like good and bad. It kind of shows, it was kind of bad in that it was a big, you know, it's a big lot of, a bit of an upset at the time, but it was good in that it just shows that people are really paying attention to the project and that, you know, there's a lot of passion and interest in this stuff out there.
Yeah. Absolutely. The one thing that was on a slightly tiny, just a tiny little sidetrack, I thought an interesting practical joke. There's this software called Woopra, which is kind of like Google Analytics combined with Jack Bauer from 24. And it's like this kind of Java application. It's all very flashy. It's really interesting. And for their April Fool thing, they said that they'd implemented a new feature in the new version, which would switch webcams on, where you could turn someone's webcam on.
That's not good.
And it causes huge furore.
It was a joke.
A joke. And and they were like, well, at least people are paying attention. It was exactly the same sort of thing. It's great. You can just switch someone else's webcam on. I like the idea of that.
So if someone wanted to get started actually having their own OpenSim simulator with somebody maybe whose name rhymes with Mio Mohort.
Mio Mohort. I love him.
Would it be difficult to get one of these started? Is it difficult to install? I mean, if you have Mono, is there much more beyond that?
It actually is kind of fairly difficult at the moment. We actually deliberately do it, which might sound surprising.
To keep Leo Lohort from using it.
We try and keep people just... Basically, I mean, it is kind of like at its very alpha stage, and we already get... There's already such a lot of passion and people contributing and kind of like feedback, and there's already a lot of... It's already quite difficult to understand. So we almost say, well, we really don't want to make it too easy to install yet, because then... We're going to get a lot of people from Second Life who think this should really work like Second Life, and it just doesn't yet. There are these things missing, and there are a lot of bugs. And so to kind of like control that, you kind of have to build it from source. If you want the latest stuff, you have to download, and on Ubuntu, which is what I use actually, you have to, you know, get all the right bits of Bono and all the rest of it. And on Windows, it's a bit easier, but you still have to compile the thing. So,
well, our server's so running Ubuntu. We don't have Mono installed, but we can install Mono. I can build from source.
I mean, then if you can, it's actually not too difficult to build from source.
Do you do an SVN pull? Is that
Yes. You can either do that, which of course a lot of people do, straight from trunk, and or there are source packages down there, so you can just download one of those and with the right bits and pieces start compiling.
I built it about an hour ago. It's really simple.
No, you're a liar. You're a big fat liar. Go back with your unicorns.
I built it an hour ago, and I followed the instructions on the website. I cut and pasted the instructions, and I felt like I had mad skills at the end of that episode.
Wow.
I love doing that. And then
you were the only one in your simulator, though.
So you're actually running it? What's the address of the sim? Come on.
So anyway, unicorns. I managed to run it, and then at that point I was confused and gave up.
I'd actually been nervous to run something that isn't reliable, not for me, but because then I have to deal with the end users also who are saying, hey, my sim keeps flying off in different directions.
It's a real... You do have to babysit these things quite a bit, but I think, you know, just time goes on, as with everything. It'll improve.
I love the idea of having our own community around that. You know, I think that would be really fun, really interesting to do.
Yeah, if you ever need a test load, let us know, and Leo can send 1,000 people.
We can
to
load
your
it. We can load it real fast. 1,000.
Maybe what we can do is I could have a word with some of my Ubuntu friends, and we can get it packaged for Ubuntu.
Ooh.
And then maybe someone can throw up a sim, and then maybe Leo can send people in that general direction.
I think that's exactly what Justin was saying he doesn't want to do.
It's like, no, stay
maybe
welcome.
In a few years when we're ready for it. At the moment, 30 is enough for a load test.
That's a good...
That would be amazing.
We don't want to push it. Yeah. We had at one point in Second Life, rather, we had a whole auditorium, a Twit auditorium somebody built, and a Gizwiz warehouse with gadgets in it. And I mean, we had this whole area. And the guy tore it down. I guess he wanted the real estate back. But he had used the virtual bulldozers or unicorns. They work too. Well, Justin, it sounds like a really, really neat project. I'll watch with interest because I do think that this is a wonderful thing to have your own community. Mm. Who wants to buy an island from Second Life when you can have the whole universe?
Indeed.
Thank you, Justin. Take care. All righty. Thanks for joining us, Randall.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
So, I mean, I'm intrigued by the idea of doing this myself, but it doesn't sound like it's quite ready for...
Sounds a little early for you.
Yeah.
Which doesn't ever stop you, but...
No, I know.
It might this time. Let's see. You were on Jaiku before it was really live. You were on.
Oh, I leave a trail of tears behind me everywhere I go. Are you kidding? Mostly my tears.
Yes. So,
yeah. But so, no, that's neat. I'm glad they're doing that. I think it's fascinating. I've always liked, and I know he doesn't like to use reverse engineering, but I've always liked this idea of being able to take a something and figuring out what the protocols are and writing it from scratch in reverse. I think that's
amazing.
A great challenge. It is. Yeah, it's amazing. It's fascinating. Must be fun to do.
It's a lot of skill involved, too. I mean, because if you really don't even know like what's going on, it's sort of like, lock picking, where you don't know what the key looks like, but you know it's got to eventually move some of these tumblers around, and you can kind of reverse engineer it from that. So it's a little bit crazy.
Well, it's no accident there are a lot of geeks who love lock picking.
Mm-hmm. It's a puzzle. It's like all puzzles.
Yep. Yep.
Speaking of Second Life, since we spent a lot of time on that in here, I actually lucked out the day that I signed into Second Life for the first time, because one of the possible last names was D-A-L. You know, you can only choose so many last names.
Right.
So I am in Second Life R-A-N D-A-L, my actual first name.
Wow. And Jono, what's your Second Life handle?
I can't remember. It was Zach Callahy or something.
Unicorn like Love.
Yeah, I was quite handsome in Second Life as well.
as in First Life as well.
I have trouble, just like me. I wasn't really all that excited, so I just kind of dialed somebody in.
I must have come late, because there really weren't a lot of good choices in Second Life. My Second Life handle is Pruneface Spatula. It's memorable.
I know a guy.
Comment conjures up an image. I haven't used it in a while. I think I paid for not quite lifetime, but I think I have a lot of Second Life assets. There's still a cottage, a twit cottage somewhere in Second Life. Probably hasn't been swept up lately, but
it's probably all dusty. You walk in, there's cobwebs in the corner. And
I think a lot of people were very intrigued by Second Life, and there was a lot of attention initially on. Remember the Reuters bureau was there, and the Swedish consulate, and so forth. And I think that some of that interest has tapered off. I'm not sure if it's because.
Well, it had a scaling problem, for one thing. When it really got popular, it didn't scale very well, and a lot of people were probably turned off by that. And it's still awkward to use. And now you can't. They got rid of that Linden script, and now you have to program in C#, I think.
Oh.
Which is just silly.
Yeah,
it's just silly. Maybe that's why these guys chose C# too, because they knew that Linden was actually using that behind the scenes
had
too.
To. And it became kind of overrun by adults and adult activities, and that really kind of turned me off too. So,
really?
Oh yeah. Oh,
really? Does that happen?
Really? Where's that at? Uh-huh.
Is that on the internet now?
Yes, they have that on the internet now. Yes. So, but I don't know if the whole idea of a 3D world is a fad, or if it really is. You know, it all comes from the metaverse, from Snow Crash. That's really where I think it all kind of comes from, this idea of having this virtual reality world that you go in, you have a second life and you participate in, and there's an economy and all that stuff. So sci-fi has kind of driven this somewhat, but it
maybe
doesn't
this
quite
will become
live
the beginning of the open singularity.
It's got to be open. There's no way, you know.
Yep.
I mean, God, I sound like a broken record, but whether it's Twitter, Facebook, or Second Life, the idea of these silos where you pour your little heart into, but somebody else kind of controls it, keeps it closed. You can't interoperate. There's no federation. It just kills me. I mean, it just seems like that's such a waste.
So is that what you're going to say about Google Wave too?
No, because Wave's open.
Okay, so I'm going to be able to run my own Wave server.
You can run your own Wave server. They're giving away the code. I don't know how open. They have federation, so that if you have a server and I have a server, we can communicate.
Cool.
I think Google did it right. I mean, this is the antithesis of what Microsoft would do, I think, if they created such a product. It's open.
We'll have to get them on the show here then when it's a little further down.
I really want to. We're going to.
That'll be great.
I think we have later this week on the Twit Live Network, we're going to get a live demo, if I can get somebody to kind of help us.
Well, cool. Yeah. I bet you have contacts at Google, Leo.
Well, I've been begging them. I wasn't at Google I.O., so I didn't get a free account, but I've been begging them for an account.
Well, speaking of guests coming up later.
Yes.
We have next week, my dear friend, Mr. Tim O'Reilly, is coming on to talk about everything that he's been doing in the past and future about open source, and about all those wonderful books that he's had. And, John, you're coming back next week, right, too, aren't you?
Yep. I'll be back if that's okay with you guys.
Will Tim be in studio, or is he going to do it via Skype?
I'm still finalizing that. I'm hoping he's in studio.
Oh, I hope so, too.
Might have a really tight schedule.
Yeah, he's not so far away, but yes, scheduling is always difficult for somebody.
And I mean, I think the reason he gave us a slightly later start time is because he's got stuff right up until that time at the office. That might not work so well.
So far, we're close, Tim.
I know
just over the hill. And by the way, I think I owe you, Randall, because guess what I got in the mail just the other day?
I heard this on last week's show, but go ahead. I don't want to rub it in or anything,
but thank you. I've always wanted to go to food camp, so I guess I may not be a friend, but at least I'm a food.
You got invited.
I got invited to food camp.
Yes, I got the invite as well.
Did you?
I didn't get an invite.
Honeymoon? Wait a minute. You have a chance to hang out with Tim O'Reilly and you're going on a honeymoon?
I've been before. Uh-oh. Sorry. No, I'm going to be there on the Sunday. So I'm probably going to... We actually get back on the Saturday night.
I have a similar problem. I have a job.
You don't want one of those.
Yeah, no. This really get in the way of things like food. Well, it's been a great pleasure, John. Thanks for coming back and we'll see you again next week. I think this is becoming a little bit of a habit.
Enjoying it. You guys are good fun to hang out with.
Oh, we're really glad that you can be here. And I don't think I said it. I think we were talking before the show began, but I just want to thank you for Johnny Jackalope and the netbook remix of Ubuntu that you guys did. Mm. I'm sorry. Ubuntu. Somebody said, you keep saying Ubuntu. It's Ubuntu.
Ubuntu.
Ubuntu. It really works beautifully on my MSI Win. Didn't have to do anything particular to tweak it. It just out of the box, Wi-Fi works and the camera works and the sound works and it's really slick.
I will certainly pass on your regards to our community.
Nice job.
Thank you.
And if anybody has a netbook, definitely, instead of putting Windows XP on it, we're Hackintoshing it, which is a lot of work. And frankly, neither of these are well designed for that little screen. This netbook remix is perfect. Big, it looks a little like Zandros, but I think much more flexible. And you have all the power of Ubuntu under the hood. You know,
that's
really
nice.
Yeah.
I also want to say that I just got to schedule the week following Jeff Shelton of the Open Source Labs at OSU. They're the ones I think that host Linux.org right now. They just got a huge bandwidth grant that basically triples or doubles the size of the university they're at. I mean, it's incredible. It's a huge bandwidth donation, and he's going to be on to talk about how the OSU Open Source Labs provides hosting for lots and lots of open source projects. He's coming on the week following, which would be a good time thing. And again, on the short list, I've got Monty Wydenius talking about the MySQL split. I've got some guys at Sugar Labs and Core Boot to talk to, Ganache, all on the short list there, Inkscape. So I'm working on those, getting those all slotted in. I'm also, follow me on twitter.com/Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, and you'll find out when I'm doing karaoke from time to time, and I do live stream that. Actually, I was really honored the other day, and Leo, I'm sure you know who I'm about to speak about. John Hamm, Mr. Ustream himself, stopped by my Ustream situation and said, "You have a really good show, thank you," and he even left a comment in my Ustream, so that was really
nice. That's awesome.
I think that's actually cool. John Hamm bot, but okay.
No, Johnny stopped by. No,
I'm just teasing you. Of course it's John.
Because he showed up and I said, "Who's this other Johnny moderator? I didn't make anybody else a moderator. Who are you?" And he's like going,
I get to be a moderator.
I get to be anybody.
I could be a unicorn if I wanted to.
I don't know what I've started.
No, but you're not going to hear the end of it today. I have a feeling, Jono. I don't want to say anything, but...
So again, stop by and follow me on Twitter. That's Merlyn with a Y.
And Jono is J-O-N-O Bacon. And of course, the community manager at Ubuntu.
You.
Do you actually have to give people lessons?
In pronouncing the name?
Yeah. Ubuntu. Free.
Free. Good.
Free.
And people who often can't pronounce canonical as well, they pronounce it as conical.
Conical.
It's not,
not comical.
Conical is not the same. I like that.
So, Ubuntu is an ancient African word meaning I can't pronounce Ubuntu.
Love it.
Very popular. Great to have you, Jono. Great to have you, Randall. We will be back next week and every week. If you want to watch the show live and get it before anyone else does, you could do that Wednesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern time. That's 18:30 UTC. Next Wednesday, we're going to talk to Tim O'Reilly, and he will be a little bit later. Is he 5:30 Pacific?
No. 2:30
Western, 5:30 Eastern, 19:30 UTC. So I'll put that on the calendar. We have a calendar at live.twit.tv as well, and that's usually kept up to date and should be fairly reliable as far as times and so forth.
And if you go to the twit.tv/floss page, you'll also get our updated calendar of future events, and you also get their contact information for how to reach me, which, of course, is floss@twit.tv. Very easy to remember.
Floss@twit.tv. Thank you, Randall. Thank you, John. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time. on Floss Weekly.